and then this T cell becomes activated, yeah, and begins to do things. In a research environment, if you're working with T cells and you want to activate them, there are two ways that you can activate them. One is you can activate them specifically with antigen. Yeah. So if you wanted to activate T cells with antigen, could you just add antigen to the T cells and expect them to become activated?
No.
Why?
It has to be
processed and has to be present on MHC, right? So what you need to do is you need to take your antigen, give it to macrophages or dendritic cells, have them process it, present it, and then the T cells can be activated. Pardon? Well, let's not talk about that right now. Okay, we'll get to that later. Right? So just regular antigen, that's what will happen. Right? If you want to activate a whole group of T cells in a research environment, another way of doing this is to add anti-CD3 to the mix. And when you do that, you can bypass the antigen presentation thing. If you add anti-CD3, it cross-links the CD3 on the surface of the cell, and the cells become activated. Okay, but that's only like in a research step. In fact, in the paper, I gave the case study that I gave you, they actually talk about anti-CD3. That's why I'm bringing it up. Okay. Alright. CD4, CD8 we talked about, and then this business that I tried to start off now with the CD28 and the CD152, or what's also known as CTLA-4. I know this is a real alphabet soup thing, but that's what makes it seem strong. So the CD28 sends a positive signal, CTLA-4 sends a negative signal into the T cell. CD40L, did we talk about that?
Yes, we did.
CD40L.
That was the last part. That's where you stopped.
So what was the story on the CD40Ls? This is what's so important for class switch in B cells, right?
Yeah.
Right? CD40L reacts with what on a B cell?
CD40.
The L stands for ligand, so it means ligand is something that attaches to something else. So CD40 ligand attaches to CD40. And that's what orders class switch in B cells. Right? And I think one of the last things I mentioned to you is that there is a group of people that have their males, because it's an X-linked problem, that lack the CD40 ligand on their T cells. And what is their phenotype? Yeah, they have what's called X-linked hyper-IgM syndrome. Because basically the only kind of antibody they can make is IgM, because they're never able to give the B cells the signal to switch. So this is kind of an experiment in nature that helps to confirm what we know about class switch, the biology of class switch, and how B cells act. And then I think I also talked about CD2, right? This is the molecule on T cells that binds to sheep red blood cells.
Wait, that can't be its purpose, though.
No, it's not. It's not. It was just discovered kind of accidentally. You know how?
No.
Some grad student, probably starting, hadn't had enough to eat, probably drank too much the night before, sitting in the lab, going, I got some sheep red blood cells. Let me see what will happen if I mix them with these T cells, or these cells that I got from a mouse or from a human. And they discovered this phenomenon just by playing in the lab. That's how all these things are discovered.
Yeah.
Sit around and you're kind of bored in the laboratory and you decide to play.
Yeah.
And they notice that certain groups of cells rosetted. Yeah, their sheep red blood cells stuck to them. And it wasn't until about 10 or 15 years later that they discovered what it was on these T cells that actually stuck to the red blood cells. do that. But it was a very nifty thing because it was the way that T cells were first isolated. Even though before they knew they were T cells, they didn't know what they were. It was just a class of white cells that rosetted. And so when they rosette, then you can centrifuge them out and leave the others behind because now they're heavier. And then you can begin to study them. And that's basically where people began to understand what these cells were and how they work. What else do I want to say in this? A couple of other things in this chapter that I think are worth mentioning is, these aren't in your notes, so I did want to talk about this a little bit. Page 108, there is a figure that describes the maturation of T cells. And what 108 is talking about now is what happens in the thymus, because that's where T cells go to school. Old-time immunologists refer to the thymus as the school of the T cells. The T cells learn how to be T cells. So initially what happens is the pre-T cells go to the thymus from the bone marrow. So all these cells arise out of the bone marrow, but they go to the thymus. There's some kind of homing for these pre-T cells that attracts them there. And then they undergo a differentiation process. And now, one of the first sets of differentiation of pre-T cells is a decision within the individual cells to go either gamma delta or alpha beta. And we call it, there's two types of T cell receptors, the gamma delta receptor, and then there's the alpha beta receptor. And so on this figure, you see that initially, you get this pre-T cell, that then makes a decision, to go either way. And you notice that they basically don't say very much about the gamma delta T cells.
Right.
Suddenly they happen and then they leave and then they show up down at the bottom someplace. And part of the reason for that is that the biology of gamma delta cells is not really well understood. I mean, there's a lot of research going on and a lot of ideas floating around about what the gamma delta T cells are and how they work and what they do and what the purpose is, but nobody is really quite sure about that. So nobody wants to talk about that much. Yeah.
But we have more of the gamma deltas than we do the alpha betas.
Do we?
That's what it says in the book.
Yeah, a lot of them hang out in the gut.
That's what I was like. We have more, but we don't know. We know less.
We don't know very much about what they do and how they operate. Most of what is understood about T cells is really alpha beta. Right? So now, what then happens with the alpha beta is the alpha beta becomes what's referred to as double positive. It's CD4 positive and CD8 positive. In the early stage of differentiation, you have these cells are double positive, CD4, CD8. And then there are a series of selection procedures that occur as these cells move through the thymus. They start out at the cortex and they move into the medulla, which is the inner part of the thymus. So if you look at the thymus has a structure that kind of looks has a very dense central area. This is called the medulla. And this area here is called the cortex. And the cells come in from this part. Your veins or arteries, small arteries that bring the cells in. And they mature by moving through the cortex and eventually in the medulla. So well, the T cells that make it into the medulla are then the mature T cells. And we're talking alpha betas. The alpha beta T cells. Okay? So that's kind of what this little wedge is trying to indicate to you, is this the pathway of differentiation. Okay? And then what happens is there are two sets of selection processes that occur. And the first one is positive selection. And that's what they're trying to show you here with this double positive cell interacting with the thymic epithelial cell. What we know is that the thymic epithelial cells are loaded with MHC molecules, MHC class 1 and MHC class 2 molecules. And in this first stage, T cells are selected for their ability to bind to MHC. They have to be able to bind to MHC. If, because remember the receptors that are being made are randomly generated, right? It's the B, D, J joinings in the variable regions of both the alpha chain and the beta chain. Is that correct? Everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? Okay. So VDJ rearrangements are generating all these different specificities. So the first test is, do these specificities bind to self MHC? If they bind to self, the cell is kept. If they don't bind to self, the cell is killed. The cell undergoes apoptosis and kills itself.
But don't you want it not to bind to self?
Because remember, it's got to recognize its own MHC. Okay? All T cell receptors have to bind both to antigen and to MHC. They have to recognize both. And they recognize self.
That's called MHC restriction.
So MHC restriction is this phenomenon of a T cell being able to recognize its own MHCs. All right. Then this cell moves on. Yeah. And it enters into the next line of selection, which is now a negative selection. And now what happens is it's tested to see how strong it binds to MHC. If it binds too strong, that's also something you don't want. Okay? Basically, you want weak binding to MHC. So in this next phase, negative selection, if it binds too tightly to MHC, it's then killed. So it's kind of like the three little bears, you know, story, Goldilocks and the three bears kind of story. Yeah, it's like this one's too hot, this one's too cold, this is just right. That's kind of what you want. Yeah? And some people have referred to this as the Goldilocks model of MHC restriction selection. Yeah? So you want it to bind. You want it to bind, but you don't want it to bind too tight. So it's positive selection, negative selection. And also, as this is occurring, that at some point during this process, the cell changes from CD, from being double positive to being single positive, either CD4 or CD8. And at that point, it's also going to be restricted to its particular MHC. CD8 binds to MHC class
1.
Yeah. And CD4 binds to MHC class
2.
Okay. And so finally at the end, the mature T cells come out bearing either CD4 or CD8 and being MHC restricted. At the appropriate level. Grace, you okay?
I'm okay, sir.
I just saw you shaking your head.
Too
much information and I just don't
want
to do that
one.
Explode!
I just
want to
stay up.
All right. Okay. So this is also recapitulated for you again on page 110.
What?
Recapitulated on page 110. So they talk about positive and negative selection on page 110. Now, the one thing I didn't kind of stress in this, the MHCs that are found on the thymic epithelial cells and on the dendritic cells that are in the thymus that are presenting MHC also have self-peptides in them. Okay. So there is, in a way, there are self-antigens in these MHCs. And that's what they show you in these pictures by either the little red or the little green fragments that are inside these. And that idea is going to become a little clearer as we go through chapter 10. Okay? Let me see what else I want to say. There's one other thing in this chapter that I wanted to just mention. They talk about a syndrome known as DeGeorge's syndrome. And they also talk about nude mice someplace in this chapter. This is DeGeorge's syndrome was a condition that really kind of highlighted or led people to understand what the function of the thymus was. Kids with D. Georgia syndrome, males, actually it's all boys, are born without a thymus. And what was recognized very early on is that kids without thymuses don't have T cells. And initially what they recognized is they had really bad immune systems and they die very, very early in life. And then they realized that it was just the T cells that were faulty. B cells were okay, they had B cells, but it's the T cells that were faulty. There is a line of mice that also has been created. These are so-called nude mice that are also born without thymuses. That's thymine would be a real plural. And these are often referred to as athymic nude mice or T cell deficient nude mice. And they're nude, they're very important for research purposes. Because neither D. George syndrome kids nor nude mice have T cells. Okay? All right, chapter 9. Okay, so chapter 9 is devoted to helping us understand what the function, what the nature and the function of the major histocompatibility complex is. And in the introduction in this chapter, they introduce you to a couple of terms. One that we just talked about, this MHC restriction idea, that the T cells are restricted to self-MHC, and that's how they work. The term histocompatibility is kind of bandied around, and they talk about the fact that initially they thought it was just one gene, but then they realized that it was a group of genes, and so it became the histocompatibility complex that people were talking about. In humans, the histocompatibility complex is known as HLA, or the HLA complex. In mice, it's known as the H2 complex. And in chickens, that's called the B complex. And chickens, actually, the histocompatibility complex was the second one discovered. So it was very early on. A lot of immunology was actually discovered in chickens early on. Another thing they kind of bring out in this chapter is that histocompatibility is really a laboratory phenomenon or a medical phenomenon, because there is no real purpose for transplantation in the natural world. We don't normally transplant, with one possible exception, and that is pregnancy. And the verdict is still out on the role of HLA in pregnancy and how it is that a mother tolerates the fetus and allows it to grow without interference.
But it has to have some natural, it's there for a reason.
Well, it's there in terms of the function of T cells. T cells, that's the way we understand it now. T cells are MHC restricted. They only recognize antigen in the context of self. And so self is very important for T cell function. Now, the idea is that helps T cells to not attack you. Yeah, there is something inherent in this process that controls the activity of T cells so they do not end up attacking the host. And that histocompatibility restriction must play a role in that. But the nitty-gritty of how or why that works, how tolerance is established, is still rather elusive. What the actual, the rules of tolerance are is a little bit unclear. If it were clear, then we could probably figure out ways to attack things like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, but we still don't really know how they work. But MHC restriction probably plays a role in that. Okay? So the first figure here on page 114, and the figure that I have in your notes, has a lot of detail in it. And so I kind of like to go through this step by step. The first thing, notice that in A, we're talking about the human system. And in B, we're talking about the mouse system. And the mouse system is important because a lot of what we know, we learned from mice. The human system was really, you know, deduced from what we knew about the mice. And we found that they were kind of arranged the same way. The first thing to notice on these is that in both of these systems, they make a very fundamental distinction between class 1 and class 2. So you see that at the top of both of these complexes. You see a set of arrows that delineates class 2, another set of arrows that delineates class 1. Yeah. Okay. The second thing is they show you the gene structure. Right? So you see the chromosome, yeah, and then you see on the human side, you see are you with me? Everybody with me? You see that on the human side, you see DP, EQ, DR, yeah, and those all represent class 2 loci. Yeah. The word locus and gene are the same thing. And then you see B, C, and A, and those represent the class 1 loci. Class 1 genes. Okay. Then notice, let's just take one of these. Let's just look at DP. Yeah. The so-called DP class 2 antigen is composed of two genes. Yeah. One for the alpha chain and one for the beta chain. Yeah. And what they show you there then is that when those genes are expressed on the surface of a cell, yeah, you will get an alpha chain and a beta chain stuck together. And that is now the DP antigen. I believe that's new, Grace. Very dramatic. I feel like doing flamenco.
I thought I turned it off.
So does everybody see how this works? Yeah? So you have the gene structure. Yeah, you have the chains that are made and then they are expressed. So you have, again, you know, the central dogma. DNA goes to RNA, goes to protein. They're not showing you the RNA step in here, but that's there. Yeah, Rob.
Is there any reason that it's flipped, like beta alpha and then alpha beta? Does that matter? All right.
So you'll notice that in humans there are three class 2 antigens. And they're called DP, DQ, and DR. Each of those class 2 antigens has two chains. And they have an alpha chain and a beta chain. They come together and then expressed on the surface of the cell.
So this isn't just an example, this is exactly how they all are?
This is exactly how it is. Now, there's going to be another layer of complexity on this. Because for each of these genes, you have multiple alleles. Okay. Does anyone remember what the word allele means?
It's what's expressed, not allele.
Different copies of same gene. Different copies of the same gene. And I believe I gave you my standard kind of recipe cookbook example of what this means. It's like you can think of a gene as the basic recipe for a particular type of protein. Or in terms of cooking, you can think of a gene as a recipe for a particular dish, right? Like potato soup, right? Or spaghetti sauce, right? So every genome has a gene for spaghetti sauce. Right? Okay, but now spaghetti sauces come in different varieties. Right? You can have a red one, or you can have a white one, or you can have a clam one, or you can have a beef one, or you can have a, you know, a spaghetti alla carbonara one, or whatever. Those would be alleles. Right? So you go, give me a recipe for spaghetti sauce. The question now is, what kind of spaghetti sauce do you want? Right? So in that kind of analogy, if we just look at DP. And we look at the DP beta chain, or the B gene, yeah, as it turns out, there are many, many different DP beta chains. in the human population. So all of us have DP. All of us have a beta chain on our DP, but not all of our beta chains are identical, okay? Because there are multiple alleles for them. Does that make sense? Okay. Similarly, and actually kind of take this, try to connect this to what you know about biology. Hopefully, this is not too foreign for you. Yeah. If we look at the human HLA complex that is described here, okay, this describes one complex on the chromosome, yeah, where this complex is embedded. Yeah. But we have two of these chromosomes, right? Because we've got one from mom and one from dad. Okay. So everybody has two copies of the HLA complex. I believe it's chromosome 17, but I don't remember that for sure, that HLA is found on. Okay?
Six.
So, what is it, 16?
Six.
Six, yeah. Is it 17 in the mouse? Somehow 17 is banging around in my head. Maybe it's the mouse, it's like 17.
Two. Oh, yeah, 17.
Huh? Am I wrong there too?
Ah. Yeah, you're right. It was MHC.
All right. So anyway, so the important thing is that we are we're diploid. Yeah. So we have two copies.
Yeah.
So you're going to get two DP beta gene alleles. One from mom, one from dad. You're going to get two DP alpha chain alleles, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Everybody's following this? All right. Okay, moving on to class one. Notice that there are three class one loci, BCA. And these loci code for what's referred to as the alpha chain for the class one MHC molecule. There's also a small chain associated with the alpha chain that comes from a gene that's located somewhere else in the genome. And that gene codes for this small molecule called beta 2 microglobulin. And that's what they refer to as beta 2 M on this graphic. Okay. And you see what happens then is that, let's just take a look at the class 1 B locus. Yeah. When that locus becomes activated, yeah, the alpha chain is transcribed from that. Okay. And then somewhere else, the beta 2 microglobulin chain is being made. And then the beta 2 microglobulin comes together with the alpha chain to make the complete class 1 molecule on the surface of the cell. Okay. The class 1 alpha chain is approximately 43,000 molecular weight, 43, 45,000, somewhere in that. Scheme of things. Beta 2 macroglobulin is about 12,000 molecular weight. On the class 2 side, the alpha chain and the beta chain are approximately the same size. They're about 30,000, give or take 30,000. Okay? All right? So that's the human system, right? Have you guys heard of these before outside of this class, these molecules, PPPR, ANCs? This is the kind of stuff when you're doing paternity testing, yeah? Like what's her face, you know, that one day, blonde girl, Anna Nicole, yeah. Oh, poor thing. Poor baby is fatherless, or perhaps we know now who the father is.
Yeah, 8:30 this morning, I guess.
8:30 this morning,
yeah.
They were going to announce it? Yeah.
Well, yeah,
the whole world is like biting their fingernails trying to know who the father of this child is. Such important
and then
news.
We're all, then once we know, it's not, who cares if we have to that.
Such important news. I don't think anybody cares at all.
Yeah.
I think the news media wants you to care.
Yeah.
Because it sells things. All right, so paternity testing. Also, if you're crime scene investigating and things like that, if you're trying to figure out whose blood is there, HLA is very important because what's important is the fact that each one of these genes is very, very polymorphic. So that we all basically have a unique identity based on the array of alleles that we possess. Does that make sense if I say it like that? Yeah? Okay. So anyway, so then in the mouse, you can see how the mouse is organized. notice that the mouse basically has two class 2 gene complexes, what's known as IA and IE. Yeah. And then they have three class 1s, K, D, and L, but they're arranged a little differently on the chromosome. Humans kind of, all the class 2s are together, all the class 1s are together. In the mouse, the class 2 is in between a set of class 1 genes. Okay? Let's see. Okay, figure 9.4. Take a look at that real quick. Goes into the structure of class 2 and kind of dissects it out a little bit more for you. I think what's probably most important is what you see in A and D up at the top of this. Yeah. And you'll notice the beta chain and the alpha chain. And notice that where the beta 1 domain comes together with the alpha 1 domain up at the top, that's the binding site for peptide. That's where peptides come, that's where they hang out. And of course that then is what gets presented to CD4 positive T cells. Right?
Yeah.
And then in D, they kind of show you, you know, what the binding site looks like. They actually have the T cell receptor coming in from the top. Yeah. And they're showing you that this binding site can accommodate a peptide roughly 15 amino acids or so long. Yeah. They're saying here from 12 to 20 amino acid residues. All right. Notice in D, they make a point about saying something about allele-specific pockets. Allele-specific pockets. What do you think that means?
That's like a key lock.
It's what?
Key.
Well, what's this allele-specific mean? Okay, the pocket's going to be where the peptide binds, right? This is where the peptide sticks. And so this area has got to be specific, more or less, for peptide. So now, what's this idea of allele specific? What are alleles now? Different flavors of these particular molecules, right? So if you're talking about, let's say, they're not saying what this is, but this could be the DP class 2 antigen, right? Everybody with me? This is DP, right? It's got a beta chain, it's got an alpha chain, okay? And what this is saying now is that my DP molecule might in fact be very different from your DP molecule. Or actually one, I have two different DP molecules. Yeah? And they both might be very different from each other and from yours. Now those are the different alleles that are out there. Okay? And that means these pockets are going to be different. And that means the peptides they bind are also going to be different. So the peptides, so this is where differences in the ability to present antigens is going to come in. Yeah? Questions are, we always ask, you know, why do I always come down with this disease? Yeah, a cold. Whereas Michelle never comes down with a cold. Yeah? Or various types of things. Why is a particular racial group prone to tuberculosis where another is not? Yeah? And we think that a lot of it depends on what alleles they possess of these antigen-presented molecules. Because your ability to activate T cells depends on your being able to present stuff to T cells. And if you can't present them, you ain't going to get no activity. Make sense? So allele-specific pockets are kind of, they're trying to prepare you for this idea a little bit, because they talked about this a little bit later on. Okay? So that's the class 2 molecule. Where are class 2 molecules found? Typically we say they're found only on antigen-presenting cells, professional antigen-presenting cells, which include B cells, dendritic cells, and also macrophages. The level of class 2 on these cells can also vary depending on cytokines that come in. In particular, there is one cytokine that's very important in this regard, and that is a cytokine known as interferon gamma. Interferon gamma, or often abbreviated as IFN gamma. Interferon gamma is often made early in infectious processes, and it has the ability to upregulate the synthesis of class II molecules on professional antigen cells. Does that make sense? Okay. Interferon gamma is often made very early in infectious disease processes. Okay. So whenever there's some kind of problem going on, interferon gamma gets made. And its presence has the ability to upregulate the production of class II molecules on the surface of professional antigen-presenting cells. So an antigen-presenting cell may have only a little bit of class II on it, but when interferon gamma comes in, those cells start making lots of it. So they become very good at presenting antigen. Make sense? So the amount of class II on a cell can be somewhat dynamic. Your book makes a point that in humans, macrophages always have class II on their surface. In mice, macrophages are often deficient in class II. The macrophages have to become activated, usually through interferon gamma, to start making a lot of class II, and then they can become good antigen. Okay. You okay, Chris? You're asleep. I'm trying to talk loud and wake you up. All right. Class one. Class one is shown on page 117. Very similar kind of picture. In fact, if you're not careful, the molecules almost look exactly alike, don't they? They don't?
No, I saw the difference.
They have kind of the same shape. The big difference is that the alpha chain in class 1 has three domains. And then it has a little beta 2 microglobulin. They also have, they have a cleft or a pocket where peptides can bind. And class 1 peptide pocket is smaller, and I think they talk about 8 or 9 amino acids. Okay, so it's a small. Okay. So let me see what else in here. They talk about on page 115 and page 115, 116, they talk about the variability of MHC genes, and that's kind of what I've been trying to say to you in different ways, this idea of having multiple alleles of every one of these chains. That's also referred to as, I love this term, the genetic polymorphism of the MHC antigens, or the genetic polymorphism of the MHC protein. Which basically means that there are many alleles to each one of these chains. Yeah. They're very polymorphic. They have many shapes. Okay. And that's, of course, what we think in terms of immunology is the definition of self. Is the MHC set of alleles that we possess, each of us possess individually, that makes us immunologically unique from each other. And that, of course, drives the problems that we find in trying to transplant tissues. Because when you're trying to transplant tissues, you need to try to match MHC protein as closely as you can. It's never exact. The only place it's going to ever be exact is in identical twins. Other than that, even in child-parent matches, you're not going to have exact matches. Or siblings. And sometimes not even an identical twins, if there's been some kind of rearrangement at the at these low cycles. Alright? So it's important for you to understand that, to understand that we're all diploid, yeah, so we get a set from mom, a set from dad, and that these sets are very polymorphic. And so anyway, so they talk about that, and then on page 116, they go a little bit into how things are inherited, yeah, and they talk about that a little bit more. So make sure you understand what that's all about. Damage that does not match to who? Well, you get rejection. So, I mean, T cells, if T cells are matched for MHC, if other cells come in that have MHC on them that your T cells do not recognize, the T cells destroy them. I mean, a whole, what happens if in transplantation if the MHC does not match? And the answer is you get rejection. And the more unmatched, the more severe the rejection. All right, so what is the true function of MHC? And this, of course, relates to antigen presentation. And we understand antigen presentation to proceed along two different pathways, depending on the type of antigen. If it is exogenous antigen, then MHC class 2 gets involved. If it is endogenous antigen, then MHC class 1 gets involved. And what the hell does that mean? Endogenous versus exogenous.
Exo is out and endo is in.
Right. So what we're talking about are let's start with exogenous first. An exogenous antigen, we're basically talking about what happens with phagocytic cells. What happens with phagocytic cells, or really, another way of saying it, is with exogenous antigen, we're talking about what happens with the professional antigen-presenting cells. Professional antigen-presenting cells. And we see this summarized on page 120. Okay, so everybody take a look at this figure. It's very, very important. And there's a lot going on here. All right, so on this figure, page 120, figure 9.5, we have a professional antigen-presenting cell, like a macrophage, perhaps, like a dendritic cell, perhaps, like a B cell, even, because B cells are also professional antigen-presenting cells. What these cells can do is they can phagocytize antigen on the outside. And in this particular example, they talk about the exogenous antigen as being a virus protein in a vaccine, or maybe a whole virus particle, or maybe a bacterium, or maybe a bacterial toxin, yeah, that this cell is ingesting. All right. Then what happens is this stuff goes into a vacuole. This is regular phagocytosis. This stuff goes into a vacuole, and it gets digested. And as part of its digestion, it gets converted into a series of little peptides. What's digesting it? Well, there are a number of so-called acid proteases. Proteases are enzymes that digest proteins. Yeah? Acid proteases are often referred to also as cathepsins. Pepsin equals or is an acid protease, which means it's a protease that's only active under acidic conditions, as these vacuoles are. These vacuoles are very acidic. So it gets converted into a series of peptides. Okay? Meanwhile, in the cell, now go down to the bottom of this picture. Okay? Meanwhile, in the cell, you've got class 2 proteins or class 2 antigens, MHC class 2 proteins, being made. Okay? And they're showing you that they are made in the rough ER, right? The rough endoplasmic reticulum. You see the little ribosomes, What are the ribosomes doing? They're reading what? What is that little thing sticking out of them?
mRNA.
They're reading messenger RNA and they're pooping out proteins. Right? And they're pooping the proteins into what we refer to as the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay? In the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum, these proteins come together, yeah, alpha chains and beta chains, come together to form the complete class 2 protein. Alpha chain and beta chain. Okay? It's not a very easy thing to do. And in fact, there are other proteins that act as, we call them chaperones, and there's a class of proteins referred to as chaperone proteins, or chaperonins, they're called. Chaperonins that actually shepherd these molecules together and get them to attach to each other. Okay? And this is shown here as CD74. Also known, it has a beautiful, almost kind of Hawaiian name to it, right? There's a building downtown that's called this. Ever been to this building? The EE building? It's the old judiciary building right downtown. The EE building. Right? So we call it the II. The II protein, or CD74, is a chaperonin. Yeah, it helps pull these class alpha chains and beta chains together. And it also does another very interesting thing, is it blocks the peptide binding site up at the top so that it stays free. Okay? And they show that to you here as that kind of red hook-like molecule. Okay, so meanwhile, the class 2 molecules are being formed, yeah, and they're being blocked, and they get packaged into vesicles, and they move up to where these digestive vacuoles are, yeah, that have digested the antigens. And at some point along this way, yeah, the two vesicles fuse, and for the first time, foreign antigen peptides and class 2 molecules come in contact with each other. A series of enzymes then remove that little piece of the EE, yeah, the little piece of that II protein, and peptides can now bind to this molecule. Peptides bind to the molecule, and the molecule gets expressed on the surface of the cell, and this cell is now ready to go. Does that make sense? Okay? And as it says here, then, this gets presented to CD4 positive T cells. All right? Now, one other little wrinkle on this is they try to describe you on page 121. And this is where this polymorphism comes in, right? Because if I'm a true heterozygote, right, how many different class 2 molecules would I have? I am a true heterozygote. How many different class 2 molecules would I have? The class 2 molecules, what are their names? DP is one of them.
Q, DR.
DP, EQ, DR. Right, so that's three. Uh-huh. Right, and then I have three from mom and three from dad.
Yeah.
So it'd be six. So I'd have six different class 2 molecules. Now that's assuming no other kinds of reassortments, and actually there probably are a few other kinds of reassortments that take place. The simple answer is six. Okay. So now, okay. In these antigen-presenting cells, when they take in antigen, on page 121, it shows you an antigen, a peptide that's come in. It's a globular protein. And it says that this particular globular protein gets digested into three different peptides, one representing residues 1 through 13, another peptide representing residues 35 through 48, and another representing residues 110 to 122. So this could be tetanus toxin, yeah, when tetanus toxin gets digested, it gets digested to three different peptides, the so-called immunodominant regions of tetanus toxin. Now, those peptides have got to bind to class 2 in order to be presented to T cells. And what this is telling you, what they're trying to tell you in this figure, is that not all class 2 molecules are capable of binding these peptides. Some alleles can, some alleles can't. And the basic idea, the theory is, we have so many so that all of our bases are covered. But there's always a chance that for certain antigens, certain peptides might not be bound. And that if that is the case, you will not be able to respond to certain parts of certain molecules. Does that make sense? Okay. This is what some people refer to as a hole in the repertoire. A hole in a repertoire. What we know is that in certain individuals, and we see this better in animals, because you can really test it in animals. You can inject different strains of mice with different antigens. And you'll notice, this particular strain of mice, no matter how much tetanus toxoid you give them, they just don't respond to it, or they respond very weakly to it. Okay? And when the analysis is done, what they find is that in this particular strain of mice, the class 2 alleles are not capable of binding to the tetanus peptides. Yeah? Or maybe out of three peptides, they can only bind to one. So there's nothing wrong with their T cells. The T cells are waiting to do it, but there's a problem in the ability of presenting certain antigens to T cells. Okay? And this is what we think also occurs in certain individuals that are prone to certain diseases, or what's often seen as in certain racial groups, let's say like Polynesians, for instance, when it comes to diseases like tuberculosis and leprosy. There's just a higher proportion of people that are susceptible to leprosy in Polynesian populations than in non-Polynesian populations. And when you go back and you take a look at the alleles that are present, you notice that there are certain MHC alleles that are present at different frequencies in Polynesian populations when compared to like black populations or white populations. All right, any questions about that? Okay. Endogenous antigens. What are endogenous antigens? Well, these are the antigens that are already present inside the cell. And probably the most salient example of this would be a situation where a cell gets infected with a virus. Okay? Cell gets infected with a virus, the virus starts to grow inside that cell. Right? That cell is generally, initially, it looks rather normal. It may start to be a little abnormal, it may start to act a little sick. But it's very important for the virus to keep that cell alive until at least a lot of virus are produced. Okay? Well, somehow, some way, the immune system's got to be able to figure out if there's something wrong with this cell. It's an infected cell. And this graphic on page 122 describes how this happens. Essentially, what happens is all proteins inside a cell. Now, a certain proportion of all proteins inside a cell get degraded and presented in the context of class 1 MHC. Let me say that one more time. A proportion of all proteins inside a cell get degraded and presented in the context of MHC class 1. Okay. So what I'm saying, you really understand that statement, is even a normal cell that is not infected is going to take proportions of its proteins and digest them and present them. basically, you can think of it this way, to tell the immune system, hello, everything is fine in here. Yeah, this is, these are my proteins, this is what's going on inside me. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. Now, if the cell is infected, of course, a proportion of proteins that are being made by the virus are also going to be present. So it's kind of a natural phenomenon for all cells to do this. And that's one of the reasons why we think all cells have class 1 on them. All cells, all nucleated cells have class 1 because they're constantly showing the immune system what's going on inside them. And they use class 1 to do that. All right? So if you follow this graphic, what you notice is that all cells have a huge garbage disposal inside them. Yeah, and it's referred to as the proteasome. Yeah? And you see it on this picture, it's that green kind of structure. It's a cylinder type structure that's found, it's a small organelle inside the cells, and there are multiple copies of this thing. And basically the purpose of the proteasome is to digest proteins. Yeah, proportions of proteins. A lot of times these proteins get another protein attached to them, and some of my tissue culture people might be able to tell us what that protein is. Remember? The protein that tells the proteasome, oh, digest this thing. How does a proteasome know what to digest? You?
I don't remember.
Be quiet, Timothy, right? Ubiquitin. There is a protein inside the cell. You would have gotten it? There is a protein inside the cell called ubiquitin that attaches itself to various proteins inside the cell. And when proteins become ubiquitinated, they then get targeted to the proteasome and they get digested. That's just a random, you know, kind of selection. Sometimes it's random. Sometimes it's very direct. Okay? For cells to go there and to get digested. The peptides being pooped out of the proteasome, yeah, then get picked up by these proteins called peptide transporters. Yeah? And yeah, they're on here. Yeah? Peptide transporters, which then transport these peptides into the endoplasmic reticulum, where they then come in contact with class 1 molecules that are being formed. Yeah, again, this is like the rough ER. Yeah? Class 1 molecules are being formed. Notice that the class 1 does not have a little E thing on it to keep it free. So as these proteins are being made, they basically start picking up the peptides that are kind of floating around inside there. And then this whole complex then gets shunted up to the cell surface, where you can get presentation now to CD8 positive T cells. And this is the way, yeah, that all proteins get sampled and get presented and give T cells the opportunity, especially CD8 positive T cells, the opportunity to react and to recognize them. And I think it's pretty damn it.
So ubiquitin tells the proteasome what to digest?
It's basically a little address, yeah, for the proteasome. So if a protein is ubiquitinated, yeah, it then has an affinity for the proteasome. It gets picked up by the proteasome and gets digested. Okay. All right. Peptide transporter, some of the things that... peptide transporter is actually, it's a protein made from two genes. Yeah. The genes that make the peptide transporter are called TAP1 and TAP2. TAP1 and TAP2. Yeah. They make the TAP1 protein and the TAP2 protein, and those two proteins come together to form the peptide transporter to move those peptides across. what I want to say here. Okay, so what we're talking about here is the recognition of protein antigens. Yeah, your book also talks about the recognition of lipids. Yeah, there's a little bit known about this. What we know there is they also have to be presented, and there is a molecule very similar to class 1 MHC. It's referred to by your book as CD1. Yeah, and your book even gives a little diagram of it that presents lipids to T cells also. Lipid presentation is a little bit odd. We think that gamma delta T cells are involved in that, but that's still a little bit iffy. Lipid presentation is very, very important, particularly in certain autoimmune diseases that involve neural function. For instance, the organisms that I work with, Campylobacter jejuni, as I think I may have told you somewhere along the line, people that have Campylobacter infections may, if they're unlucky, develop a paralytic disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome. And the prevailing hypothesis about how Guillain-Barré syndrome arises is that T cells reactive with lipids on Campylobacter then become reactive with lipids on your nerve cells, and they destroy nerve cell function by doing that. So lipid antigens are real important in this kind of thing. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot about them. Kind of an open area for study. Okay, what else do I want to say about this chapter? There is a bit of a discussion in here about why. I mean, after we've talked all about this antigen recognition, so far we've talked about the fact that T cells are selected, right? They go through positive selection, negative selection, yeah, so that they're just right in terms of their ability. And then there's this whole business about antigen presentation, so that only antigens that are properly presented, yeah, to T cells will then be capable of eliciting a response. So the question really is, one of the fundamental questions is, why do we normally react only to invading organisms and not to ourselves, given the complexity of what's going on here, right? Because we do have T cells that are capable of recognizing MHC, even though it's still kind of weak, right? But in a normal situation, we don't really react to ourselves. Yet, under certain circumstances, things can go very, very wrong, and we can react to ourselves very badly, right? And these are still really fundamental questions about how the immune system is regulated and what maintains this regulation so that we don't get killed by this thing. Is there something flying around over there? The only answer I can give you, and the answer your book pretty much talks about is first is that we really, first off, select for T cells that are only minimally reactive to ourselves. That's kind of the first line. And then the second line, given the fact that we still have T cells that are reacting to ourselves, the second line is that we only seem to react to things that are also capable of generating other signals. Okay? And this, your book refers to as the danger hypothesis. Okay? That your body must recognize something as being dangerous in order to respond against it. Okay? What does that mean? How does your body know that something is dangerous? Well, the simple answer is, and this goes back to the beginning of the course, the simple answer is, we know that the immune system, or at least the innate branch of the immune system, is capable of recognizing these so-called patterns associated with pathogens, right? So pathogen-associated molecular patterns. It's kind of the acronym that people use. Pathogen-associated molecular patterns. Pathogen-associated molecular patterns for PAMPs. PAMPs, pathogen-associated molecular patterns. And so what we generally see is that in most productive immune responses, you not only have an antigen that triggers T cells and then probably also B cells, but you also have a molecular pattern that triggers macrophages to get angry and produce a bunch of cytokines. Or you get some kind of inflammatory response that is induced by this. Remember, this is innate. And the T cells are the acquired part of the immune system. And the short answer in answering why we generally do not respond to ourselves, but we do respond to pathogens, is that pathogens are capable of getting this second signal. We do not automatically cause inflammatory responses in ourselves. But a pathogen is capable of getting it. And you need both together to get a good immune response. This, of course, also leaves us open to a lot of other, paths to follow. If you happen to have some kind of inflammatory signal being generated at the same time something else is going on in your body, you may very well induce autoimmunity. And we do see that. We see autoimmunity sometimes as a consequence of certain types of infections. And it may be that there's some kind of short circuit in the system when that occurs. All right, the last thing in this chapter that we need to talk about is this business about super antigens. And I've also given you a case study that you're supposed to read. Has everybody read that case study? The toxic chocolate. Has everybody read that? Well, it looks like we're out of time, so I'm going to let you go today. But on Thursday, we're going to pick it up with toxic shock. Super antigens first, and then toxic shock. And then I'd like to get into chapter 10 and possibly 11. Okay?